Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking technology a little bit, taking a look at your computer and maybe your phone as well. And I'm sure we're going to be talking about your phone. It's kind of a computer anyway. And phone companies are making a big deal. They always have about the changes. I can remember 3G to 4G. Now we're going to 5G. So we'll talk about what those changes actually mean to you and to me. And to help us with that task, Jesse LaGroube. Back with us once again. He's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Works with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. So what questions do you have about your cell networks? Are you having a technology problem of some sort? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jesse LaGroube, welcome back.
It's good to be here.
All right, so what's the G in 5G?
So at least for a lot of cellular, they made it a little bit easier. You know, we also hear the wireless that we normally have in our homes, 802.11abg, all these letters that seem to make no sense, and then they start adding letters on top of each other. For cellular, it's been a little bit relatively easy. So G stands for generation. So we originally had 1G, which was the first kind of cellular network that we had, and kind of increasing in feature set and complexity over time. And currently we're at 4G. And the variety of networks, including what 4G and 5G have, they're going to be a little bit more complicated as well, because there's different feature sets and different use cases. But really, G is just generation. So we're at the fifth generation of this wireless technology.
All right. So we're at four. What's the big change from four to five?
Usually the biggest change that we see is speed. So we get more speed. And usually that's just about what everyone's concerned about. I just want it faster. I don't need anything else. It just needs to be faster. In this case, that is one of the promises with the technology, although this also opens up a lot of different possibilities and a lot of different use cases. So people just using their smartphone, you know, they're going to be able to stream content that they couldn't do before, but it also opens up possibilities for virtual reality, remote connections, what they call the Internet of Things. So, mm-hmm. You know, everything that we have right now that we consider a not smart device, like a refrigerator or a vacuum that we push around, well, we're going to have different devices that are connecting in a variety of ways. And some of those are things that we regularly see in our day-to-day life at home, but they also might mean things that we see in factories, self-driving cars. Imagine, you know, somebody performing surgery halfway around the world virtually using this wireless technology as a backend to enable the transmission of the data, you know, the data required to do that effectively. So there's a variety of use cases for it. Usually it's the biggest speed, but I think there's going to be a lot of use cases that that enables that are, you know, outside of just standard day-to-day cell phone use.
Yeah, that's cool. Will it be available everywhere around the country, around the world?
A lot of different companies right now are focusing on the connections for like major cities. So if in your major city, they're going to start testing with this wireless technology, and it kind of goes out from there. And I think what we're used to seeing right now is probably going to be pretty similar. The further out you are from a major city, the less likely you're probably going to see it. The one benefit to this, and this has been a challenge for everyone, if you're in a more rural area, getting an internet connection can often be challenging. Yeah. A lot of times there is the cost of running cables. Running cables is a significant cost or a significant effort, and many times you can actually have very fast fiber connections laid throughout the state, throughout a city. And usually the biggest cost or the biggest barrier is it taking it from where it sits to the home to make sure that you can actually make that connection. Having this 5G wireless allows you to actually stand up a wireless connection instead of physically connecting a home or a different location up to this, you know, back end pipe, you can do it wirelessly. So there might be other options in the future for expanding internet service using wireless instead of using traditional cables. So there's, you know, some benefits there. So you might see it more, but I think it's going to be used in different ways. It'll be used to bridge some of these back-end connections instead of actually taking these physically to these properties.
And will that, how would it affect the equipment we have now? I mean, are you going to have to throw out your old phone and get a new one, or...
There will most likely be, so, you know, the biggest question is it backwards compatible? And at least for most of the information I'm seeing, they're using different frequencies, they require different hardware, so they will not be. You're going to need, if you want to take advantage of 5G, you're going to need a different device because it requires a different radio, a different chip in your phone, your laptop, or if you're using any kind of wireless bridge at home to connect from cellular as a hotspot, you're going to need a new device there. So, unfortunately, it's going to require an investment in hardware, which also includes the software behind it. And at least from, you know, initial things being discussed, even for a cell phone, that could mean, you know, $200 or $300 increase in a device because you need this new technology that, you know, manufacturers are still, you know, getting up to speed, and agreements are being put in place based on, you know, which company are going to go with for whatever chip. Is it going to be Samsung? Is it going to be Intel? So you're going to need new hardware. They're going to need the 4G to still remain.
If I don't want to spend $200.
Yep, you're gonna need to have that. Those remain. There could be, you know, potentially hybrid and different towers or consolidation. Although you're gonna need 4G separately, and a lot of companies right now are preparing for 5G by putting things in place and using it for 4G, and then flipping the switch when all the software and everything is ready to convert it to 5G. They have all these specifications they kind of work on. They've been working on this for quite some time. It was just finalized over, you know, in 2017, and there's a lot of kind of quote-unquote 5G networks or 5GE networks that are available. They're not traditional. They're not actual 5G compliant. They don't meet the specifications. So there's going to be a lot of rework depending on, you know, the carrier that's already put these in place. But the nice thing, if people move to 5G, especially heavy consumers, that actually leaves room for 4G.
Oh.
So, if things are really congested right now in an area for 4G and you have a significant population move to 5G, which offers greater speed, should in theory allow for more, you know, devices to utilize that service, you free up space in 4G, which means that people actually utilizing 4G might get better performance. So they can use it a little bit more effectively than they had in the past, just because this new people are just going to this other thing.
Early adopters.
Yep. And they always, a good, you know, way to think about it is if you have, you know, a freeway going from point A to point B and you have two lanes, well, you know, everyone's kind of congested in two lanes, and you can say, well, that's the existing 4G network. But if you add two more lanes and they're 5G and people are moving to that 5G, you're freeing up space. So it allows for more people to utilize the existing service and hopefully get a better experience than what they have now.
Well, we have some callers online with questions for you, so let's go to Michelle first in Milwaukee. Michelle, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Oh, sure. Okay, Jesse, talking about 4G, I have a Samsung Galaxy Prevail LTE 4G. It's possessed. It has never provided me with 4G service, and at the top, it always says 3G. I've taken it back to Best Buy. I've called my provider, which is Boost, which is affiliated with Sprint as far as cell coverage, and no one can give me an answer.
That's a really difficult one. Have they tried to swap out your device, or have they tested with any other device to either show you that it does connect with 4G?
No, they haven't.
Okay.
That's a good idea.
And a lot of times connecting to 4G, connecting to any kind of network is location specific. So if you're in a certain location, you simply may not have it available. And that that just might be the case. You can find different pockets in different areas where you can get 4G only if, you know, potentially if you're in one building, because even the construction of the building can give you interference that you're not expecting. So I can't really give a concrete answer, although I would be interested to see if they could show you a device that's connecting to it, at least to show you the difference, because it could just be the case that where you are, even in that store, they can't connect to 4G, so they can't actually show you what it looks like, and that kind of puts you in a weird spot, because you actually might not be able to use it based on where you are right now, and you could always go to different carriers and find out about their services. And many times they're piggybacking off of each other's equipment. Sometimes they're not. But I would actually go back to see if they could show you a device that is connecting to 4G and maybe see what the difference is.
Is there any chance it's connecting at 4G and just telling you it's 3G?
It's a possibility. Generally, I would say it's usually going to give you the right information. Okay. In terms of the connection. There's always a possibility that that's the case. Usually over time, since the phone's been developed and usually updated, I think that'd be a lower possibility.
Okay, there you go, Michelle. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Vern in Voigt, we go to you next. Hi, oh, Vern.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
We have this what's called Unix time date stamp, and it's 10 to the 32nd, or 2 to the 31st power, minus 1, whatever. And we run out of time on January 19th, 2038. It's called the 2038 problem. How are we going to solve that? That may be why the Samsung is not working properly. Apple's got the lead in the technology, the way it seems, but we have all these embedded systems, wireless embedded systems, mm-hmm. like your vehicles, your ABS systems and all that, aircraft carriers, nuclear weapons. How are you going to solve the problem on a worldwide basis?
Well, I won't be solving the problem on a worldwide basis. That's one thing I can guarantee. And this is actually a very similar problem to kind of what we've seen in terms of they usually kind of call it, you know, buffer overflow when you think about the number of digits you can see in a certain space. So let's say you have 4 bytes and you have 4 ones. Well, if you add one more, everything turns to zero, which, you know, kind of resets everything, which is really not something you want. You want the time to be accurate. You want that data to show you what you actually have. And so this is kind of the case with this 2038 problem, where everything, when you hit a certain area, it could revert to zero and it just kind of starts over. And I actually remember researching this little issue a bit. This was kind of in the area of the Y2K issue.
I was just wondering that.
When we use 2 digits instead of 4, because when you roll over from 99, you just roll over to 0. You don't roll over to 2000. It doesn't say 1999. It just says 99. So it doesn't really help you. So it's a similar problem with this. Really, the fix in many cases is built in software. So even with the case of the problems we had with Y2K, a lot of it was, updating some hardware, upgrading some software to handle it properly. And now, whether we're actually applying this and thinking about this right now and doing something, I'm sure some are, I'm sure some aren't. I'm probably less concerned just due to the nature of what we've been through before, although there are a lot of instances where we tend to forget the lessons of the past and how are we actually going to apply what we've learned. So, you know, is there some solution? Yes, there's a variety of solutions. A lot of it can be software based and a lot of it can be hardware based. So if, for example, in this case, I think it's the amount of storage you have for the data. We have more and more storage as we've developing different hardware. We have the capability of potentially storing more and more data. And it's just a means of updating the hardware and the software accordingly to adjust for that. And without looking in the 2038 problem a little bit more, it's an interesting problem because it's kind of a repeat and you're like, wait, this can happen again. But it is a real thing. And we just need to make sure that we can account for that maximum value and actually, instead of rolling over to zeros, rolling over to the next value. So for example, if we're using 32 bytes, well, if we run out of space there, we need to use 64 bytes. And it's a means of increasing that. The same thing we ran into with IP addressing. So we have our IPv4 addresses were kind of ran out worldwide, and they had something called IPv6, which a lot of companies are adopting to ensure that we have enough space, because we never thought we have a ton of IP addresses. We're not going to run out. And we're like, oh, yeah. We were short-sighted. We didn't think about the types of devices, people having five devices as one person and actually using it, like a cell phone, a gaming device, a TV. These were completely unheard of or unthought of, so they developed new technologies to replace it. I think IPv6 is still probably underutilized in a lot of areas, but it kind of mitigates that risk a little bit. But granted, in this case, we need to make sure we have appropriate handlers in our software and hardware to account for it.
There we go. Thank you so much, Vern. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Dave Poltratz, our engineer. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your computer today and your phone with Jesse LeGrew, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions for Jesse? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Richard in Antigo next. Hi, Richard. Richard, are you there? Perhaps we lost Richard. Well, we'll keep trying on Richard there for a minute. In the meantime, again, join in at 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. I've noticed that if you're in a more rural area of the state, your phone will say 3G service.
Yeah, usually when you hit a certain distance, you kind of fall back to the next highest speed. So having 4G or 4G LTE, you'll kind of notice if you were in, a more populated area, usually bigger cities, when you do kind of come away from the center, it'll drop to lower speeds, either based on the physical availability of that service, or usually if it's congested, you're just kind of stuck and it really doesn't help you too much. But usually it will kind of fall back to other services if it's unavailable.
I think our next caller is Kathy in Beaver Dam, so let's go to Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Jesse, do you know if the 4G is going to be dependent on line of sight to the towers or the transmitters?
And this is specifically for 4G or 5G?
This would be for 5G, and this would be for rural people who are not going to get fiber anytime in the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
Okay. And I haven't looked into the specifications for 5G. A lot of things could come into place. Having line of sight will improve you being able to get the service, because anything in between you and the tower would add interference. I don't think you need to have a clear path, but the less interference you have in between you and the tower, the better. And in this case, I think, depending on where, if it's a rural area and if you don't have the capability of accessing 5G, from a more metropolitan area directly, I do believe that at some point they would, and this would, I think, be in the provider's best interest as well, actually utilize 5G from more local sources to broadcast internet connections from physical cables that are actually closer to your area. So they could actually put in a more rural hotspot based in your area, rather than running physical cables from building to building. So it does open some other possibilities, but you might not be able to get directly to, a metropolitan area. Line of sight always helps. Having less interference always helps. So there are some challenges there.
All right. Thanks for calling, Kathy. Appreciate it. Let's go to Sean in Madison next. Hi, Sean.
Hi there. My question, I have actually two questions. With the new 5G cell services, how will it change the landscape in regards to antennas? And what will there be more antennas? And also with IoT, with the Internet of Things, what do we have to worry about security-wise having more Wi-Fi-enabled devices in your home that are all connected?
Well, in terms of antennas, since all of these 5G is going to work on kind of two different frequency ranges, and these ranges generally don't overlap with a lot of the other wireless, which means generally new antennas, new connections, even in this case for other devices that we're using like cell phones, computers, or hotspots, they're all going to utilize different hardware, which is going to mean new and different things. Existing antennas could potentially be reused for one service or another, although, you know, it's going to be a challenge. So we're still going to have antennas of some sort, and, you know, even cell phone companies are creating cell phones that actually have antennas based on the frame of the phone so you can get more service. So we're not going to get rid of antennas at any point in the near future. I think companies are still trying to hide it as much as they can and make it usable, but we're still going to have something. Hopefully, the more we move closer towards one technology, we're able to deprecate and remove some of the older stuff, and that will at least streamline kind of what we're seeing in terms of antennas. For the, you know, Internet of Things and the security aspect, I think this is something generally a lot of people are kind of worried about, especially with devices in their home that can listen to them. When is it recording? Where is it being stored? When we do have a cellular network that can be reached just about anywhere in a variety of ways, it does increase the likelihood that you're going to have a device that can communicate with it, that can do a variety of things. And, you know, that's really a concern for your own personal security, what the products are doing on a day-to-day basis. So, for example, if they're controlling your doors, if they're controlling, other ingress and egress to your house, what are the ramifications of that, especially if they're on the network and could potentially be attacked all the time. And, you know, that doesn't even include all these other personal assistants you might have in your home, things that might be recording data. So it's a real scary thing, and it's also really scary in terms of industrial applications, things we use for life safety. There are a lot of benefits to being able to connect devices together so you can control it and gather data from it. From a safety perspective, that helps, especially if you know of something sooner and can act sooner. That also adds additional risk, where if the system fails, how do you know? And if, you know, something else happens, you actually don't get the data you need, there's risks there. So there's a lot of risks to it, depending on how we implement the technology. Those risks have always been there. In this case, the availability of the technology just exacerbates it in a different way. So there are challenges there. Everyone kind of makes their own decision on how risky or where that goes. And, you know, it is a real concern. It's a lot of devices, and they can do a lot of things. And I think the things that we're doing with those devices now, I think that's going to expand with 5G, and we're going to have new capabilities of it. And even when they talked about self-driving cars, those cars are going to be a part of the Internet of Things. That's just one other device. The nice thing is potentially having collective data from all these devices could also offer safety, where you could have devices that are connected in various locations, offering GPS data. Could a self-driving car utilize that information to navigate better? Hmm. Maybe, maybe not. But it's just other data sources that you can use in different ways. Downside is, in many cases, it's your data. So how comfortable do people feel with that data kind of being out there, and how is it being used? So, you know, I'd always recommend everyone always read your terms of service, always know what you're agreeing to. It's a hard thing to say, especially because sometimes you're reading through 20 pages and you might not really understand it, because it's understood by a select few people who draft these agreements and really understand what this language means. It's almost like you need a lawyer to help you interpret this data, which, you know, might be the case, because it can be very complicated.
I've tried reading those, some of those, and I mean, they're like almost unfathomable.
Yeah, they can be very wordy. They can also have a lot of dependencies. So you can read one agreement and it's dependent upon five other pieces of data that you have to go into and research. And if you don't understand everything within that end user license agreement or acceptable use policy, terms of service, you just have no idea. You need to know all of it in order to actually understand what that document means, even if it's a page.
Talking with Jesse LeGru today, questions for him maybe about the phone, the 5G, or maybe you've just got a computer issue that you want to discuss with him. Join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Lynn wondered about problems of radiation from cell phones. Can you talk about that in maybe in general terms?
Yeah, so first I'll just I'll state I'm not a doctor, so I can't, you know, say anything about the health benefits or detriments of using wireless technology, but it has been a concern for a variety of time. And I think just cell phones in general, it was always a concern. What is this doing? Is this doing anything? And I think there have been conflicting pieces of data saying, you know, there is an issue or there isn't. For any kind of adoption of technology, it's always important to know the health implications. Could there be a concern? I think it's definitely worth exploring. There could be a concern there. I just don't have the data myself to actually state. Now, with 5G, if we're using it more, it's actually going to be more saturated than what we're using for 4G or any other wireless. If we're using it to put up hotspots in rural areas, that's, you know, wireless that wasn't there in the past. So it's very likely that even if you work downtown, come home, and like 50% of the time, you're kind of in that environment, 50% you're not. It could be more like 80 to 100% you're in that environment. What does that do? I'm not really sure. There is a lot of studies about that, and I wasn't certain if there was anything conclusive, but they talked about really the skin being your largest organ and interacting with any kind of wireless signal. What does that do to you? And I think there's still more research being done. I haven't seen anything definitive of we have to stop using wireless altogether. But anything we do environmentally does impact us. We've seen that not only with technology, but anything else that we do. Our environment does affect our own health. This is something we're putting up, and there is likely going to be some kind of impact, whether it's the power going to these areas or something else. There is some kind of effect. The question is, what is it?
Yeah. A big question for sure. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Phone in with your questions or comments as we talk with Jesse LeGru today. By the way, I should mention at noon today, we'll be broadcasting Wisconsin's 39th annual tribute and ceremony honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The live event is hosted by Jonathan Overby, and there'll be music and talk, and it should be a wonderful tribute. And that this show will be 60 minutes today instead of the normal 90 minutes. So if you've got a question, now would be a good time to get it in. Let's go to Alan DeForest next. Hi, Al.
Yeah, hi. I've got a computer which has Windows 10 on it. In here, a month or month and a half ago, Windows sent out an update, and it was downloaded automatically. Well, the problem was when I went back onto my computer, I could not get onto it. I had all kinds of issues. I called Microsoft quite a number of times. Finally, they decided, well, they would download a new copy of Windows onto my computer. But the problem is that I lost a lot of the information I had on other programs. And I had my programs backed up online, but it really didn't help me very much because when I went back online, I did get my pictures back and I got my documents back. But these programs, for instance, I've got a calendar on there. I lost all the dates that I wanted, and what I got back from the company that did it online was, I've got all these files, but I have no idea what files that I need. So basically, it was no help. And then the other issue is that I'm always afraid to use a password manager, because what is going to happen when I can't get back onto my Windows? Do I lose all of those passwords and then have to update passwords for every place that I've gone to? So is there some other way of doing things, or am I not using the online backup service properly?
And for the online backup service, it sounds like you were able to get a lot of the standard files, but a lot of the programs that you use in the day-to-day basis just either didn't have the data or the settings that you were looking for. Is that correct?
And the other thing, too, is that these programs, they have all these different files. Well, the program, when I downloaded it again, how do I know what files to put back into that program? I guess that's maybe part of the problem.
Okay. So there's, at least for Windows, there is one standard folder within your user account that usually has most of your program data and settings. This is usually completely separate from anything you have in your desktop, anything that you have in My Documents, and usually it's really just for program settings, program data. So for example, if you're using Outlook and it has email and calendar data in there, many times you can download it again, but it's always cached on your computer if you don't have the internet. That's actually within a folder called App Data, APPDATA. That's actually in the root of your user account within Windows. So C users, then your user account name, and then App Data. This folder contains most, if not all, of your program data. Now it depends on the people creating the software if they do it in a standard way. But if you restore that folder, usually that's going to restore the application data that you're looking for. It is a hidden folder, and depending on how your backup software works, it may have backed it up or it may not have.
Does that help out, Al?
It does. Well, then maybe you can tell me one other thing. And what about these password managers? Now, I would want to be sure to be able to get that. Would that go into that same folder, program data?
It could, if you install the program, you know, many times the program will need to know where your password manager file is. The location of that file is probably listed in that app data folder somewhere, but more than likely your actual password file, whether it's using something like KeePass or Password Safe, is probably stored somewhere in your My Documents folder, or it's somewhere on your desktop.
That helps a lot, though.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Well, Jesse, you're still in the business of dealing with people's computer problems. What are the biggest ones that come up for you these days?
Actually, password managers is one of them, and that was one thing I was going to note as well, because you have a variety of options when you use password managers, whether they're stored on your computer or even stored in the cloud. Granted, there's other security considerations there. But if you do utilize a lot of different devices, or even just want to make sure that if your computer fails, you have a backup, you can use different cloud solutions. So I can use one password manager on my phone that I use on my desktop, and I can even share that with family members so we can do different password sharing. So if there's accounts that me and my wife need to check, we could find ways to do that using a password manager that allows sharing. So password managers are a big one, because people are creating more and more accounts these days, and a lot of the recommendations for different services don't use one email address, which is a little terrifying, because if you use 30 services, that means you need 30 email accounts. Well, how do you manage that? And one way to do it is using a password manager that can do pieces, and then only using certain email addresses to communicate in certain ways. That depends on how high your level of paranoia is, but it also helps when you don't have one thing compromised if this one account's compromised. It just puts everything into different areas, which secures them a little bit more. So the online hygiene is probably a big one, because most people use services now that they can pretty much go up to any computer, log in, get to their data and to everything they use on a daily basis from a web interface. They don't even have to necessarily install something. So having a password manager is really important, because it can help to keep your information secure, and using two-factor authentication for any service is a good idea, because if somebody breaks your password, they still can't get into your account as long as you enable that feature. And I've seen it where somebody will break into a password, and then they'll turn on two-factor authentication as an attacker, ensuring that somebody else can't come in to really unlock or regain ownership of the account. So managing your passwords, knowing what accounts you have out there, is still a big one. People still, you know, need updates, and I think more people have been comfortable with updating their computer on a day-to-day basis. But it's, you know, a lot of mobile use, a lot of moving around, and managing your passwords and how you access all these services is still, you know, a significant challenge.
That two-factor analysis is kind of interesting, because we've just, it's been recently adopted on campus for some things. And in that case, you have choices, but I chose to go with the mobile phone choice, which actually is pretty easy to use.
Yep. A lot of them are really, really nice and easy. Some of them require, you know, when you sign in, go to this app, get a code, type in the code, hit enter. A lot of them are, and that works really well because you have certain steps you need to follow, but some are also mobile where you have your phone and you just hit approve or you hit deny. Makes it really nice, really easy. And without having that phone, there's no way you can do it. So having two-factor authentication, especially in that kind of enterprise scenario, is really, really good to have. And I'd say if you can enable it for everything, I'd say enable it for everything, because it helps to protect all that data.
Talking with Jesse LeGrew, information security architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. We're taking a look at wireless networks. We're taking a look at computer issues. You may have one. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your phone and your computer today with Jesse LeGrew of Madison College's Technology Services Group. Larry Mueller here. Let's take some more calls. Ron in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance now. Ron, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I called and made the suggestion before your guest was talking about, you know, password management, and I do have that. I suppose they call it a keychain, at least on Macs. But I also use a Rolodex, too. So it's handier than having to go online sometimes. You just reach for it. And the other thing is, I have a question. Most of the time, my modem and router work. They're two separate components. But yesterday, I had the darndest time trying to get my router to work. It's a Linksys. And, you know, it'd be okay one day, and then the next day, you know. Sometimes the Ethernet cord plugs come loose. You know, that little snap clip that holds them into the jack breaks off. But I don't know. My modem's working okay, so I just circumvented the router.
Yeah.
One thing I'd probably recommend on your router, just to check if you haven't recently, is to see if there's any updates in terms of the firmware or the software on the router that might help. It also might be worth checking in with your ISP, your internet service provider, in the event that something changed where it could cause some kind of compatibility conflict with your router. It's a possibility. I tend to doubt it. And with the cable issue, because those tabs actually do break off quite a bit, I'd actually recommend probably getting a new cable, just because it will help ensure that there's a nice fit, and making sure, you know, you hear that click. You should hopefully hear that. It shouldn't just kind of wiggle in there. I've used cables that aren't the greatest in terms of that. So make sure that you do have something you actually can hear that click when it's in there, and you get a good connection.
There you go. Thank you so much, Ron. Appreciate it. And let's go to JP in Silver Lake. Hi, JP.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hear a lot about these password managers. I was a satisfied customer of Dashlane, and I think it's like a $30 subscription for the year, and it updates across all my devices, which is great because I got a tablet, I got a phone, I got sometimes I have two phones, one for work and one for personal world. But one thing I found about Dashlane is that it doesn't work with Mozilla, and I've got a certain level of internet paranoia, as you mentioned, and I use Mozilla because it doesn't track me. I use DuckDuckGo because that doesn't track me. But my Dashlane won't autofill with Mozilla, and so now I have LastPass, and now I've got two password managers. I'm probably going to drop Dashlane, but just wanted to hear you talk about which password manager does what, and if you have any recommendations.
And one thing I did take a look at, because for Mozilla, I'm making a guess that it's for Firefox, and Dashlane actually does have a Firefox plugin that I think you can install. So it could have been that the plugin actually was not available when you originally needed or wanted it, but it does look like they do have a plugin available that you can install directly available on the Dashlane site. So dashlane.com/firefox-install, which hopefully will add the plugin to your browser. In terms of, you know, which one I like the one that works for me. Everyone's going to be a little bit different. Having the compatibility to use it on different devices and to use it in different browsers for me is really useful. I'm used to working through some more cumbersome steps to get something to work, but I've used LastPass really in previous employment, and I just tend to like it on a day-to-day basis. It has a family plan, so I can share it. Yeah. It also has free options and multi-factor authentication. So for me, it works really well, but there's a lot of services out there. Dashlane's one of them that people really like, and it works for them on a day-to-day basis. And if you do have multiple devices, using a cloud-based solution really is useful. Even on the previous comment we had about, you know, using a Rolodex, depending on, you know, how secure you want it, sometimes that Rolodex can actually be more secure than a cloud-based solution or multi-factor authentication, depending on how, you know, well locked up and how unavailable that Rolodex is. So, you know, people are going to use the solutions that work for them. Each of these solutions has some risk, but those are risks that are, you know, different based on all of our situations. If somebody says, yeah, I have all my stuff in a Rolodex, but they happen to live in a mountain and like no one can, you know, get there, I don't know, that's pretty secure. No one's just going to walk in and be like, oh yeah, I know where your Rolodex is and I'm gonna take that. But there's great online services. I would take a look to see if you can install the Dashlane plugin, because it does appear like it's available. But I've heard a lot of people like Dashlane. I've used and do use LastPass, and it works for me.
There you go. Thank you so much, JP. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Willow next in Highbridge. Hi, Willow.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
For my Samsung that I have, I get these random pop-ups when I'm on the internet.
Okay. And you want to get rid of those pop-ups?
Yes.
All right.
For those pop-ups that you're getting, have you been receiving them the entire time you've had the device?
Yeah.
Okay. One thing I'd probably recommend taking a look at, a lot of phones, depending on what the carrier is, it'll come with a lot of different applications kind of pre-installed into the phone. I'd probably take a look to see if you could actually get rid of as many apps as you don't need, because most likely there's some application on the phone causing the pop-up. It could be something that you installed, although in this case it sounds like something that might have been there from the very go. It could be advertising or something else. I would look to remove basically any app you don't need. For a Samsung, since it's going to be Android-based, you should be able to go to the Google Play Store and see all of your installed applications and also uninstall apps that you might not need. Did you have any specific information from the pop-ups that do come? Is it
some are ads that have nothing to do with me at all, and then the other ones are just random.
Okay. Can you tell, do the ads normally take the full screen, or do they only take a portion of the screen?
The full screen.
Okay.
And then I have to try to get back into what I was doing. And
okay. Yeah, I would recommend uninstalling apps, going to the Google Play Store to do that. One other thing I actually might recommend, this is kind of a last-ditch effort. If you can, I would actually, and first before doing this, I would make sure that you can back up all the data on your phone, including contacts, phone numbers, text messages. There's applications to do it. There are also some service centers that will do this for you as well. You might actually be interested in going even into your service provider and resetting your phone, which will, if you do a full reset, it will delete everything. So once again, I just want to make sure that you back up anything you need, go into a place that can help you with it, and clear out any data, restore it. And I would actually use the phone for a day or two, especially if it happens frequently, to see if you get any pop-ups. And then if nothing happens, start reloading your data. And if you do notice that the pop-ups occur again, keep a log of kind of what you're doing, what you're installing, and what you're restoring. It's likely that it could be one of those items that's creating the pop-ups. So that's one way you could kind of go all the way back and do that, although it would be some effort depending on how much data you have on that device.
Yeah. Does that help, Willow?
Yes, it does. Thanks, Jesse.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Jan in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hello. I have a wireless printer that used to work, but for a long time I have not been able to get it to work in wireless mode. I've reestablished the connections with the, you know, the private code and so forth, and I'm not able to get it to work. Recently, I read that many people don't update their printer software, and I'm wondering, could that have something to do with that? And if I don't have the original installation disk, I can't find it, how do I do the install for any updates?
And there could be updates for the device that could have changed it. In this case, normally, you know, for if you have your laptop and your router, you know, wireless device and your printer, if nothing changes, usually everything keeps working. So even if the printer itself doesn't receive an update, things should be okay. It could have just been that something got a little bit of out of whack or something changed. It's kind of hard to know. What do you know? What manufacturer of printer you have?
No, I don't recall offhand.
Okay. And if you look at the name, if you go to your control panel and devices or printers, it'll, you know, normally list the name there, and you should be able to see it on the printer itself. Most printers, you can download the drivers online. What I'd actually recommend doing is probably deleting the printer from your computer completely, go to the website, download the driver, and it will go through the full setup process. And I think doing that, you'll get updated software, and hopefully it'll reconnect for you without an issue.
All right, there we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, we're starting to run out of time here. We have Grant emailed to say a simple solution to data loss is to use a clone on a separate drive ready to restore. He uses Super Duper, and Carbon Copy Cloner is another option.
Yep, those are great options for Mac OS, and you can use the built-in backup options within Windows. Most of the backup options are built-in and free, so I definitely say go ahead and use it. One thing I'll also note, and this is previously from the wireless and line of sight, with the new 5G wireless based on the frequencies, it kind of dissipates sooner, so it might be more of an issue with line of sight, but hopefully you'll see those rural hotspots popping up within, it'll probably be 2 to 3 years, I would guess, but allowing more service availability.
Jesse, it's always a pleasure. You're going to be back in March, and we'll do this all over again. Look forward to it. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Jesse LeGru is Information Security Architect at Madison College's Technology Services Group. He assists with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. He'll be back in March, and we'll do this all over again with him. Coming up, the Ideas Network will broadcast Wisconsin's 39th annual tribute and ceremony honoring Dr. Martin Luther King. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.